Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Tortoise Shack podcast. Little bit of housekeeping before we kick off. We need your support. The Tortoise Shack relies entirely on you to keep the show on the road, mics on, lights on, and conversations like the one you're about to listen to keep happening. The simplest way to do that is to click the link that says patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It is at the top of the pod right now. So while you're listening, give us the 90 seconds it'll take you to click in, find the level that suits your budget, and help keep this show on the road. It is the easiest bit of activism you can do, and you'll get a ton of additional content, including lots of exclusives, all of our podcasts in one consolidated feed, and they're entirely plea-free. So not only will you be helping keeping these microphones on, you'll be giving yourself the gift of not having to listen to me beg, but beg I must. So one more time, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. My name is Rosie Mead, and I'd like to welcome you to the Muscled podcast. Today, my guests are Dr. Patrick Bresnahan from the Department of Geography at Bannute University and Dr. Naomi Milner from the School of Geographical Sciences at Bristol University. I'm delighted to welcome them both to the podcast today. And the focus of our conversation is their co-authored book, All We Want Is the Earth: Land, Labour and Movements Beyond Environmentalism. And that book was published by Bristol University Press in July 2023. Before I get into my conversation with Naomi and Patty, I want to say just how fabulous a book it is. It's absolutely bursting with ideas, energy, and what I think I'm kind of describing as a sense of open possibility, without being in any way blasé about the scale and complexity of our ecological crisis. But I'm also very conscious that in a book that's so full and rich that we're just not going to be able to do everything justice in our conversation today. So listeners, you've got to go and buy the book, read the book, you know, share the book, do what you need with the book. But there's so much to explore in it. And I think the authors have done a really great job of kind of signposting interesting ways of thinking and talking about ecological politics, but also as guiding us towards kind of new sources of inspiration and new writers. So I suppose before we delve into the contents of the book, Naomi and Patty, it'd be great to hear a little bit about your own academic and activist interests and how they've shaped the intentions behind All We Want Is the Earth. And I'm particularly interested, I suppose, in what motivated you to make this intervention into the wider conversation about environmentalism at this time and what you're seeking to do through the book. And of course, that also the title of the book is intriguing, All We Want Is the Earth. And I think that relates to a song by James Connolly. So maybe Naomi first, I'll invite you to maybe share your thoughts on what's taken you into this book
and what you want to do with it.
Sure. Thanks very much, Rosie. Yeah, I mean, the first thing that jumps out to me is to say that this book began with an accident. We met at a conference that was about alternative pedagogies, different ways of thinking about teaching and learning beyond the academy, which I'd say is one of our shared commitments beyond our academic work. And I was over in Dublin to give a workshop related to that and then got hit by a car on my bike. So I was laid up for a week and then got into deeper conversation with Paddy and his friends. So that's kind of the birthplace of this book. And from the beginning, I think those commitments to thinking about ideas outside the academy was really central. But also we quickly turned to thinking about quite conceptual ideas about political disagreement. So what does it mean to not just be able to like talk about politics, but to enact a kind of disagreement that would change the scene? We both were working with the theorist Jacques Rancière in our PhDs, and he kind of talks about disagreement not as between the colour white and colour black, but between two colours that are both considered to be white, but are not the same thing at all. So we started to have conversations about what those sorts of understandings might offer to our political moment. I was involved in different kinds of environmental activism and also border-related migration related activism at the time beyond my PhD studies. And I'll let Paddy speak to his own interests as well. But that sort of started to sink into a conversation that we were both engaged with about ecological politics, how we speak about it, how the ways we tell the story and frame the stories, who the figures are, who the heroes of the stories are, matter when it comes to thinking about ecological futures.
Yeah, that was a really great answer. Nice to remember that meeting. I would just add to that the book is also born out of frustration. So you ask about the motivation for it, and I think it's a frustration that a lot of people share, which is that, you know, we have all the information. You know, the science is categorical. You know, this summer you don't have to look very far to just, you know, see how bad things are in terms of the climate crisis, an ecological breakdown, but nothing seems to be happening, or a lot is happening, but not that is, you know, changing that situation. And I think the film, we open the book with this film, Don't Look Up, which came out in 2021, which really kind of caught a bit of a zeitgeist, I think, which was about this frustration. And it was a kind of a satirical take on how, you know, a meteor is going to destroy the earth and nothing can happen. But I think that we're frustrated also with that framing in the film, which sort of pits, you know, a scientist, you know, certain sort of scientific experts against, you know, these sclerotic, you know, political institutions and corporations. And there's nowhere in that story, going back to this idea that Naomi was getting out of, kind of the importance of stories and narratives and how things are framed, for social movements and radical social movements, whether that's labor movements, anti-colonial movements, anti-racist movements. And so our response to that frustration is to look at the edges, to try to find other places where there has been disagreement, where there have been movements that have linked ecological and social justice concerns in fresh ways, in interesting ways. And even if those struggles were not successful in terms of what they were specifically looking for, their demands, they continue to offer inspiration, hope. And, you know, I think as we end the book, it's very much that we see, you know, an important task of sort of reviving these histories, these sort of minor histories or counter histories, you know, today. So, yeah. Do you want me to say something briefly about Connolly?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay.
Because
So briefly about the title, you know, which we obviously thought about for quite a while, but the title comes from this folk song, as you said, that's attributed to Connolly from the early 20th century. The book isn't really about Ireland. I mean, there's some bits in it that are related to my own work, which is based in Ireland. But Connolly is this, you know, very important anti-colonial figure, anti-imperialist figure. He was a Republican, socialist, nationalist, living at this sort of, you know, very important time in the early 20th century, not just in Ireland, but across, you know, particularly the British Empire, where there were struggles against that empire. I think one of the things that drew us to that song and to Connolly as a figure was that he was a labor organizer, but was also involved in rural issues related to the land, agrarian struggles. He was born in Scotland, had lived in America, you know, did a lot of his organizing work in Ireland. So he was part of this sort of transnational, internationalist movement, anti-imperialist, anti-colonial movement, but was also very aware, you know, very aware and very smart about the specific conditions in Ireland and what that meant. And I think that, you know, as if you read the book, there's something about that internationalism, that transnationalism, that sense of kind of openness or transversal, or maybe the word is also intersectional now, between different struggles, and that task of kind of organizing across those different struggles and different sites that seems so important. And Connolly sort of is a figure that sort of, I think, embodies that sort of spirit, that kind of generous spirit. And then I think another thing is that the song itself is called Be Moderate, and it's kind of a joke on how, you know, we don't want to tinker around the edges. We want everything, you know, we want the whole earth. And that is a revolutionary demand, a revolutionary question. And I think we think or believe that we need a revolutionary politics, and it's not going to happen, you know, tomorrow. The revolution's not going to happen tomorrow necessarily, but there needs to be radical, transformative, systemic change. And that is revolutionary change. So I think that there's also that connection that is important to maybe emphasize.
Yes, that's really fantastic. And I'm really sorry to hear about your accident, Naomi. I hadn't realized that. So I hope you're well recovered. But I think one of the things that really struck me reading the book was, and it's kind of, you've alluded to it, is how there were movements and ideas that I certainly didn't know everything that you talk about in the book, but some ones that I had known quite a lot about or had been really, you know, inspired by, wasn't really thinking about anymore. They had moved away from my consciousness. And I thought that, particularly in relation to the Ogoni people, in relation to Zapatistas, that was like an example of like where I thought, yes, this was really great. This was a really great history. And we don't really think about, talk about it in the same way anymore. But we'll come back to those ideas later. I suppose another kind of very distinctive feature, and it's quite a deliberate feature in the book, and it contributes, I think, to this sense of open possibilities, is the way that you sort of break with the conventions of academic writing. So you, between your chapters, you include what you call interludes, and you use a lot of images, a lot of photographs, a lot of stills from protests, from images of maps, for example. You also draw on poetry. You also reference like other media like cartoons and films and sort of like, so there's a lot, I mean, so there's all the academic and intellectual currents, but there's all this others as well. And my sense is that that's actually really, it's, there's multiple reasons why you do that, but that you're really emphasizing the importance of aesthetics in shaping how we conceive of the environment and also how we conceive of environmentalism. And so I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, Naomi, maybe about how that about that creative approach that you adopted and how that idea of aesthetics is used both as a kind of a concept and as a device within your book.
Thanks, Rosie. Yeah, and actually, I really like the way you just described the project of the book. That kind of gets to the heart of it. So thanks for that generous reading. But you're right that I think, although it can seem counterintuitive, we take this question of environmental politics into aesthetics, into a terrain we think matters perhaps more than anything else in terms of making environmental futures. And by aesthetics, we really mean ways of seeing and saying and sensing the world, where that gets forged, and that the way that gets forged comes to mean that certain characters get framed as being central and others as peripheral or not connected at all. So that's really why we dive into different moments. We're looking at how are figures and movements and conditions articulating with each other to produce some of the key movements and key moments in the history of environmentalism? And then now, when we come to tell those stories, which ones do we remember and which ones do we not remember? And what are the implications of remembering some and not remembering others? So when we're talking about aesthetics there again, we were both quite influenced earlier on by reading Jacques Rancière. So there's the idea then in the way we see and sense the world in Rancière that senses are being policed so that things stay the same. You have the idea of the police saying, move along now, there's nothing to see here. And for Rancière, politics proper is a disruption of police conditions so that a part that has no part in that visual order or sensible order can make itself of some account and restore, if you like, the way the scene is seen and perceived. And Rancière is very much, in his European coordinates, May 1968 was a really important time that he was involved with. And we were in dialogue with other field sites, Paddy particularly with Ireland and myself with Latin America, where a lot of my fieldwork takes place. So we wanted to think rather in quite global terms in about what gets counted in global environmental politics and what doesn't. And to look back at the moments, again, that were key moments of ferment or where new movements emerged, and to see what was happening that we no longer remember to be happening. And where were their connections where we no longer remember connections? So we wanted to do that partly in the stories that we told, but it also, because we're interested in that cultural production of advertising, literature, visual art, media, which we think are really important in systematically reinforcing particular environments as scenes, we wanted to include that content as well in the way we told the story and to try and almost tell visual stories that show rather than tell some of the connections that we're interested in. So really, we're interested above all in how consolidating particular scenes in historical moments comes to foreground some actors, human and non-human, while backgrounding others. That's kind of at the heart of that aesthetic project.
Yeah, thanks very much for that. And I suppose one of the images which really kind of actually has really stayed with me is it's kind of a mad image of advertising. And it kind of cuts to maybe to what I'm going to talk about with Patty now, of all these like animals dancing about how great, you know, like DDT is. Do you know what I mean? Like it's, you know, like and they're sort of like in this kind of embrace of all these critters together, like hooray for DDT. And in a way that kind of segues into a kind of another story about environmentalism. And this kind of idea of kind of modern environmentalism. And we're going to talk maybe a little bit about like the kind of perception of when that is invented. But I suppose you've already maybe talked, mentioned it, Patty, but you talked about the Adam McKay film from 2021. But also, I suppose, kind of more conventional or kind of more staid representations of the environment. For example, the Framework Conventions on Climate Change or the COPs. And, you know, we've become increasingly familiar with these sort of as kind of key players, the ones who tell us or talk to us about the environment. But I suppose one of the concerns you raise is that in the, that how they kind of talk about the environment, the coordinates that they use, the language, represent a form of what you call modern environmentalism. And that you see that as sort of inherently limited. And limiting, it's dominant, but also dominating of other points of view. And I think it's a very useful concept, this idea of modern environmentalism. So maybe you could maybe explain to us like what you mean by that and why you are approaching it critically in the context of your book.
Sure. Well, I guess it gets to the point that Naomi was making, which is this idea of what is foregrounded and what is backgrounded. So, you know, part of the book is tracing how what we call modern environmentalism becomes consolidated over the last 60 years through particular, you know, we choose particular moments, particular images, particular institutions, say, that sort of develop a certain consistency around a certain way of framing what is environmental and what isn't, or what counts as environmental. And then against that, the bulk of the book is about how that's challenged or how that dominant framing is challenged. So, you know, when we talk about modern environmentalism, I mean, we in the introduction of the book, we talk about how it starts sort of after World War II. This was a time where, particularly in the US, there was, that sort of massive sort of rollout of technologies, new chemical and industrial technologies that had kind of been sort of advanced during World War II, that now there was a peacetime economy, a drive to find sort of applications for these technologies, whether in agriculture, whether in, you know, manufacturing, expansion of suburbanization, all of these things, which, as you alluded to with these adverts that we show, this was the sort of, you know, the promise of the new world, all, you know, whether plastics, PVCs, you know, all of the, particularly around chemical, industrial, you know, chemical technologies, also used in pesticides and so on. There was this promise that there could be abundance, there could be progress. But there was obviously this dark side to that. And that is where the environmental movement sort of kicks up. It is, and we'll talk about Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and so on, including in the US, already centered in the US, the kind of mainstream environmental movement sort of arises to sort of challenge these new technologies because they have these impacts on environments, on bodies, and so on. So that's one of the temporal frames that we use, starting from the end of World War II, the 50s, 60s, up to the present. But we also are very clear that what became modern environmentalism, how it responded to these issues, inherited traditions, aesthetics from a much longer period. And so we can look at ideas of wilderness, for example, this idea of nature without people, this sort of dualism, which is obviously a fundamental element of colonial modernity going back to the 16th century, has had a lot of attention by environmental humanities scholars, sociologists, and so on, with the likes of John Muir, the wilderness movement, preservationist movement, conservationist movement in the 19th century, early 20th century. This idea of these vast sort of wildernesses or areas of nature that nobody lived in. But as many critical scholars, indigenous, anti-colonial, Marxian scholars have pointed out, you know, this is produced through the clearing of land. Again, going back to the 16th century, colonization of the New World. Ireland is a key site for that, where, indigenous claims to land, indigenous ecological knowledge, language or so on was erased in order to make that land available for other activities, whether that was for, you know, production plantations or for tourism, you know, for leisure and so on. So it's really important for us that idea of the kind of erasure of colonial histories and colonial geographies and the kind of political economy to that hasn't gone away and is still very central to a lot of what goes under the name of global environmental governance, global climate governance. And what that means is the assumption that there can be access to indigenous lands or access to post-colonial lands for carbon offsetting, for forestry projects, for pollution sinks. And that type of, relationship or dynamic has a clear sort of lineage through this longer past. And one of the things that we show, I think, through a lot of the movements that we look at is how in objecting to modern environmentalism, one of the things that particularly anti-colonial agrarian movements have done is reassert or foreground those colonial histories and say that these have not gone away. They are very much here. This is not an event that happened in the past. It's an ongoing process and it's systemic. And this is what we are challenging. So that's crucial. I think related to that idea of people without nature, we can also talk about labor and modern environmentalism, its relationship to labor, which is often seen as a negative thing, particularly like blue collar work. And then the last sort of blind spot we talk about is around science and this idea of universal science, which again shares that idea of nature without people, this idea that there is some kind of passive backdrop of nature that we can, you know, measure, monitor, manage, and somehow erase the fact that there are other ways of knowing those environments that are often embodied, situated, and so on. And those are quite abstract, I think. But, you know, when we start talking about agroecology, for example, or indigenous science, it becomes very clear, I think, what that looks like in practice.
Yeah, I want to say that one of the like really lovely features of the book is the way that you make that kind of weave between theory and practice and kind of concrete illustrations and examples. And I suppose the kind of idea of modern environmentalism is a kind of a temporal aspect to it in the sense that you are sort of starting off at a certain point in history, you know, post-World War II. But you're also very mindful of those longer term modes of exploitation and sort of oppressive logics and how they kind of track themselves into what we understand today. So I think that point is made very clearly, robustly across the kind of the book and within a kind of very internationalist frame. And I suppose, Naomi, you said this already, and I think it's really, really important that we kind of, you know, emphasize it, is that one of the key purposes of this book is to challenge who's seen to count in terms of environmental politics in both the past and the present. And I suppose one of the founding myths, and we've already kind of circled this a little bit, is that, you know, that, you know, environmentalism started off in 1962 when Rachel Carson wrote her book, The Silent Spring. And this is in no way a takedown of Rachel Carson, by the way, but like she was involved in a very kind of important campaign around raising awareness around DDT and pesticides in the US. So there's, you know, obviously a significant contribution was made there. But you want to say also, though, that there's a wider body of knowledge and activism around pesticides, intensive farming, and the harms done by the workers, communities, and the earth that is ignored or forgotten about or deliberately sort of obscured. And you point, for example, to Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers who organized migrant farm workers in California. And also to the Mexican agronomists who kind of pushed back against the Green Revolution. And their work predates Silent Spring, actually. It comes before it. And again, they're raising serious questions about pesticide use and the kind of intensive farming methods. So do you mind maybe for listeners who wouldn't be so familiar with that context, maybe to talk us through some of that history and why you think it's so crucial that we recognize our debt to those movements?
Sure. Great. So we're talking about connections really that were being formed in the social and political spheres in the same moment as Carson's Carson's important political project, which is also a feminist project, seen through another lens, challenging the way that bodies and lands and atmospheres are perceived and what gets to count as evidence in scientific terms. So that revolved around DDT. And actually, you know, it is interesting that DDT had been known to have negative effects on bodies and lands far earlier than the 1960s. But this was the moment where legislation started to become solidified. But in the same year, really, that she was doing that important work and getting into the papers, there were other characters at their work. And our case really is that these movements were important to each other, that they supported each other's work. But when we come to tell the story, we only remember certain characters who fulfill certain aesthetic criteria about what a hero of an environmental movement can be and look like, etc. So, for example, around that time, Dolores Huerta, who was born and raised in the US, and Cesar Chavez, who was a Mexican migrant to California, co-founded the National Farm Workers Association, which would later become the United Farm Workers Movement. And they were organizing from the early 1960s, particularly around the pesticide problem in California, but primarily as it affected workers, their bodies and their families. Obviously, so the work Carson was doing was to kind of explain and show and make vivid the fact that if you use DDT, it moves through the ecosystem and get into the birds, silence the birds, and into human bodies as well. But what was obvious to those working in the fields is that these chemicals affected the body in really problematic ways, affected health, led to different kinds of illness and sores and so on. And this presented certain challenges because while they knew this and they knew sickness was growing among the workers, it wasn't appearing as a political problem anywhere else. And it was also difficult to collect the evidence in order to make it appear because people were moving around and precarious in their work as well. So one of the things we do in the book is to kind of follow how the steps through which that evidence was collected, collated and presented, overlapping with the time where Carson's work was raising public awareness of the environmental problems associated with DDT. So they co-articulate with each other to make DDT appear as a political problem. And one of the moments that was most significant in that was a consumer boycott of Californian grapes organized by the UFW. So that's really interesting because it's kind of at the intersection between the workers' concerns and growing US concern with bodies and public health. And that's kind of when you start to see the dominoes start to roll, that change has to happen in policy. So it's that concern with what were the conditions that allowed change to happen, but also with that selective erasure and remembering that mean, why do we only talk about Carson now when we think about DDT and the history of the environment? And then you also mentioned the agroecological histories that we tell in Mexico. And this is, again, a similar point in history. And the reason we draw in this story in that particular chapter is to highlight another racialized aspect of remembering and storytelling, because in parallel with these US-based struggles over whose bodies could be exposed to which harms, the same chemicals were being applied to fields in the then called Third World with much less attention and regulation. And here we draw quite a lot in the book in a term developed by Rob Nixon called slow violence, and this could also be thought of as an example of that. So slow violence is the idea that we think about fast and catastrophic kinds of violence that cause harm on bodies. What we sometimes don't notice are the different kinds of experiment with chemicals or with military technologies and so on that are enacted. And there's a kind of aesthetic selection over which sites and which bodies will get exposed to those that seems to be rendered acceptable. And because you don't always see the effects straight away, it doesn't always receive media attention, but decades and decades later is when you see those fields and those bodies influenced by contamination. And so from the 40s onwards, Mexico was kind of a bit of a test bed for ideas about modern agriculture, ideas including genetic modification, fertilizer technologies, and so on. And the justification was the kind of food poverty that it was facing in that moment, according to US visitors. But there was a lot of critique, even at that time. Geographer Carl Sauer was one of the important white critical voices. He was consulted by the Rockefeller Foundation on plans the US had for Mexico to radically change their food production technologies. And he wrote quite a famous letter back to them, anticipating the damage that would cause to local ecologies and economies, and advocating a more bottom-up process that would respect the kinds of agricultural technology already in play. But again, his comments chimed with a wider group of agronomists in Mexico, such as Edmundo Taboada, Edmundo Limón, others who were already in the process of documenting and collating aspects of campesino technologies that were very commensurable with their environments and could be scaled up in a kind of slower way. So this was kind of the birth of agroecology, we claim. It's interesting because agroecology itself is often seen critically as a bit of a white import from the 1990s to solve problems caused by development projects, etc. But actually here we present it as quite a political effort to represent existing agricultural practices as political and as innovative. And that continues today. So yeah, that's why we joined those two quite different movements that were happening in related time periods together in that chapter.
Yeah, I thought that worked really, really well. And I hadn't at all been familiar with the kind of Mexican agronomists and the work that they had been doing. So it was really, I think it really shows the power of what you're trying to do in terms of sort of, you know, because again, there can be assumptions like, nobody was saying these things, or this is kind of brand new insights. And I think that's kind of idea, well, no, we never knew about this before, is a very powerful way of depoliticizing moments in the present as well, you know, and also presenting a particular kind of versions of history. And I think that that's really powerful element of what you're trying to do in this book, is by saying, actually, these conversations have been going on, you know, in all kinds of places, you know, over a very long period of time. It's just that what we're choosing to see and what we're choosing to listen to, that's where the problem, I think, is existing. I suppose, the book is obviously like wholly committed to kind of an internationalism of spirit runs through it. And I think it's really interesting then that one of the kind of themes in the book is that you refer to the kind of recurring imagery of environmentalism. And I hadn't thought about this at all. And I was really struck by it. And I was tickled in the aftermath of reading it, how often I actually saw that imagery subsequent to reading about it. And I think that readers probably will be familiar with this kind of image of the globe suspended in space, you know, the Earth as a globe, and looking very vulnerable, looking very whole, and sort of evoking a kind of a sense of that we need to do something to protect it. And you talk in the book, Patty, about how that kind of iconography kind of emerges very much in the late 1960s and early 70s. And of course, it's linked to space travel and the ability to take photographs from space. But I suppose what it's kind of like melded into in the terms of environmental politics is a sort of a one worldism philosophy that we share this planet together. We all need to work together to conserve it, to protect it, and to protect the environment. And that's kind of a global unifying project. So this idea of one worldism. Now I'm going to talk again in a little minute or two just about some of the critiques of that. But before we get into that, you actually are quite critical of that kind of notion of one worldism. And it's differentiating it from the kind of internationalism, which I think is so crucial to what you're talking about. Would you maybe explain just what one worldism means to you and why you feel it's necessary to approach it critically?
Yeah, thanks. You've got a lovely way of articulating parts of the book that hearing them back, it's sort of clearer than when we wrote it sometime. But so that distinction between one worldism and internationalism, I think, is really helpful. So one worldism, this is in the chapter, which is really about this period, 68 to sort of 72, which is a crucial period, sort of politically, culturally, environmentally. And the idea of one worldism comes from 1972 is the Stockholm Conference, which is really seen as the first global, summit or conference which engages with environmental questions, environment and development. And in the lead up to that conference, there was quite a lot of work done by some academic scientists around this idea of, you know, needing to sort of take care, or the other word is maintain, our one planet, our shared planet. The other term that becomes popular in this time is spaceship Earth. So this idea of the Earth as being somehow a sort of a spaceship that has different sort of components to it that needs to be sort of tinkered with in a kind of a mechanical way. And I think what's interesting about that is that at one hand, that seems quite benign. And the people who were putting this forward were not nefarious people. You know, they were good scientists and well-intentioned and so on. But it is worth sort of pointing out, just as a basic sort of, you know, fact, that as this idea of one worldism, or this idea of building an environmental politics or building an environmental project around a common foundation or a universal foundation, at the moment that is sort of being pushed and platformed, you have some of the most intense social revolts and revolutions happening around the world. So, you know, we can look at, I actually have a quote that's not in the book, but it was going to go in the book, by Kurt Vonnegut in 1969, who was the countercultural writer. And he's commenting on that picture that you talk about, Blue Marble, which is this picture of the Earth from space, from the moon. And he writes, "Earth is such a pretty blue and pink and white pearl in the pictures NASA sent me. It looks so clean. You can't see all the hungry, angry earthlings down there, and the smoke and the sewage and trash and sophisticated weaponry." And what he's getting at there is, it, you know, this is kind of the height, maybe not the height, but the Cold War is very much advanced at this point. The Stockholm Conference is not for the whole world because the Soviet bloc is not there. China is not there. A lot of newly independent countries in the Third World are maybe present, but present on quite different terms. And are becoming quickly, Vietnam was very live at that time, are becoming the front for the hot war of the Cold War, if you know what I mean. So this was a time of that type of struggle, but you also had the student revolts in 1968 in May. You had labor struggles. You had feminist struggles. You had all of these things happening that were effectively saying no, refusing the idea of some kind of shared common planet, and imagining very different horizons of what the world could be. And a key, I guess, counterpoint to one worldism that we talk about in that chapter is the idea of the third world, which, you know, for people, most people, I think, is associated as something, something to do with poverty, something to do with a lack of development, something to do with aid, you know, which kind of comes in the 80s and 90s. But the third world as a project, this is Vijay Prashad, talks about the third world not as a place, but as a project in the sort of 50s, 60s, as these countries were sort of breaking free of European empires and colonial rule, they were starting to form, through the non-aligned movement and other types of sort of regional and international associations and so on, the possibility of something that was not first world capitalism and was not a certain kind of Soviet model of communism, but something different. So there was this incredibly emancipatory, liberatory moment when this was being put forward at precisely the time the one world of global environmental governance, which then has become consolidated since, was being put forward. And we think that's a very important moment of disagreement, to go back to the very beginning of this conversation. Yeah,
and I think that one of the kind of key points that you're also, and it's kind of a key element of the project of the book, is to sort of say movements and politics that doesn't look like environmentalism, we need to reclaim that as part of the ecological struggle more generally. And I think that in relation to that kind of the kind of issue to be taken with one worldism, and again, Patty, I think you're going to speak to this, is that there were, at that time, you've mentioned feminism, anti-racism, anti-colonial struggles, you know, anti-capitalist struggles of various kinds, anti-militarization, all of these are occurring. But one that kind of you kind of give a lot of attention to in the book is attempts to rethink work and how we engage with work. And you mentioned people like Andre Gortz, Maria Tronti, Selma Janes and Silvia Federici, and movements such as, you know, autonomous Marxism, wages for housework and zero work. And I suppose, again, some people may know little, may not know anything at all about them. So I just thought it would be interesting for listeners to hear a little bit about what those movements were about, and how they repoliticized or newly politicized work. But also why are they, you know, we can understand why they might be anti-capitalist, but why do you also see them as part of the ecological struggle?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's a big question. And those movements are many and varied, and they get, from my perspective, they get too little space in the book probably, but obviously the book is trying to do a lot. But I think for us, it was very important that there was something about this idea of the refusal of work at this moment in the late 60s and 70s. It wasn't just about anti-colonial or decolonial movements. And so a key figure that we, you know, talk about a bit in the book in that section is André Gortz, who was a sort of Austrian-French thinker, moved to Paris after World War II, became part of what is known as the New Left. So this kind of a humanist reading of Marx, and trying to think about ideas of human liberation and freedom in a more expansive way, you know, without getting into a lot of the debates around that. And so people like Jean-Paul Sartre, Ivan Illich, you know, people in the UK like Raymond Williams, E.P. Thompson, and so on. And some of the kind of questions that Gortz was writing about in the early 70s, who's now a key figure within degrowth, which is, you know, had a real kind of, you know, resurgence in the last 15 years. And Gortz is kind of key to that. Some of the questions that Gortz gets at are to do with technology and industrial technology. So this is in a response, as I said, to, you know, the kind of industrial chemicals, pollution, these kinds of environmental problems. So trying to think about, you know, in industrial capitalism and industrial technologies and the problems they give rise to, and trying to not be like anti-technology, but trying to think about, okay, so how can we think about, you know, technology in a way that would serve the public good, that would have social value? And how do we think about, you know, designing that technology or so on? There's a wonderful essay called The Social Ideology of the Motor Car, which is still so relevant today that I'd encourage anyone to go and read. And he also talks about work. And both in his discussions about work and technology, he is a Marxist thinker. He is anti-capitalist. And what his argument is that as long as work and technology are, you know, harnessed to the imperative to produce profit and competition within a capitalist system, they will continue to cause problems for workers and the environment. So there has to be a liberation of work and technology from capital. And when you start talking about that, you're not just talking about struggles over waged work, as in we want more money for the work we do, or even improving the conditions in the workplace. You're talking about a refusal of waged work altogether and opening up a whole new space to think about what does labor look like freed from the constraints of the wage relation. And so in that sense, it's a very radical proposition and question. And clearly he's not in a vacuum. So the autonomous Marxists you mentioned, like Mario Tronti, writing in the 60s, also putting forward this very provocative you know, position of what happens if we refuse waged work? We refuse the position of the worker within capital. What does that look like if we free up our time, if we start to create autonomous institutions and so on? And then also related to that is the feminist struggle against sort of hierarchies of work. So within that, that waged work and the waged worker has a particular sort of a higher value, with not just within capital, but often within leftist thought and leftist organizing, that you organize around the industrial workplace and the worker. But what about those who are outside that workplace, who are in the home? Women who do all of that work, the reproductive work that's not waged. So here you had Silvia Federici and Selma James and the Wages for Housework movement that was an international movement, you know, refusing that by saying, we want to get paid. That was the provocation. But it was really to sort of highlight that this hierarchy of waged and non-waged didn't make sense within an understanding that all work, in a sense, is harnessed to the capitalist imperative to make profit. And we kind of make a link between that and what was happening in the Third World, where there was also a refusal of the unpaid or underpaid labor of former colonial populations in producing resources and goods that were consumed in the metropole. So you could make the argument, I mean, we don't go fully that way, but you could make the argument that in that time, one of the things that was connecting a lot of these struggles, and that's what Zero Work, which was a collective of, you know, North American, European, Italian, you know, thinkers like Sir Peter Linebaugh, Harry, what's his name? Cleaver Jr., Selma James, Silvia Federici, George Cofensis, a lot of those thinkers, what was uniting them was this idea of zero work, was that you could trace you could analyze these different movements from feminists to workers to anti-colonial subjects to black militants as a kind of a refusal of work and an attempt to create alternative institutions outside of, you know, capitalist wage relation and the kind of hierarchies of value. So that's very, very brief, but yeah, hopefully that says something to your question.
Yeah, I think that's really, really useful. And again, I mean, as I mentioned at the start, you sort of signpost lots of really interesting thinkers and writers and activists that people should and I think will follow up in light of your discussion. And obviously, you're kind of making a very strong sort of connection between the sort of our large environmental predicaments, you know, and the coexistence with capitalism. So, you know, that notion of that anti-capitalist critique is absolutely fundamental to kind of environmental ecological struggle. But also, I suppose, and again, this is also kind of dealt with in this chapter, capitalism is racialized and it has its origins in the colonialism and in empire. And I think, Naomi, you're going to maybe speak to this kind of discussion, but In the book, you write that anti-colonial thought and praxis are discounted from histories of environmentalism, while the environmental dimensions of anti-colonial movements and decolonial theory are likewise underplaced. So it's kind of a double theft going on there. The kind of the environmentalist credentials of decolonial and anti-imperial struggle are discounted, but also we don't make those connections in the other way either. And you... I really, really enjoyed this kind of discussion, and you kind of bring into focus two particular writer activists. There's Amilcar Cabral and there's Sylvia Winter, and I just would be really interested if you want to talk a little bit about who they were and why you find their ideas and activism so generative and so helpful, maybe in terms of remaking connections between anti-decolonial and ecological struggles. And again, I suppose it dovetails back to what Paddy was saying as well about this kind of concept of kind of non-aligned movement, because again, there's this wider shadow of that non-aligned movement and kind of ideas around third worldism that we tend to regard negatively now because there's negative associations with that word. But there is a much more interesting kind of lively kind of ferment of ideas and activism that's going on there. And again, it's not being located as part of that kind of broader ecological struggle.
Great. Yeah, thanks for the question. So really, I think what's so important in why we've associated these different characters and movements is part of our argument that anti-colonial, anti-racist movements and environmental public health movements and so on were essential to one another in this moment. So we're sort of talking about the late 1960s here. In a sense, they kind of produced the conditions for one another to function. They supported each other's efforts to produce conditions for political disagreement. So including the regulation of chemicals, the acknowledgement of environmental degradation, erosion, deforestation, etc., things that we'd associate with environmental projects, but also debates that are connected over access to land, dispossession from land, questions of reparations, etc., many of which are obviously still owed and incomplete in that sense. So in a way, we're not saying they all wanted exactly the same things or doing that in the same way or would have agreed with each other, but we're talking about conditions for enacting disagreement over the way the world is organized. And in relation to this increasing one world, this impulse, then we have these different movements pushing for alternative visions. So we have, we're talking in the same chapter that Paddy was just talking about, over those questions of refusal of work and different kinds of work. At a similar time, we're also pointing to the development and consolidation of anti-colonial movements that wanted very different visions of global governance, in a sense. And as in Mexico, the agroecology case I was just talking about here, the idea is that these things are connected. So the history of colonialism and of capitalism is in many ways driving the erosion of cultural capacities to look after land and care for species and so on. The idea of environmental devastation isn't this kind of disconnected, unexpected phenomenon, as it's sometimes framed when we look at environmental problems, as if they only happen in the 20th century out of nowhere, or only linked with questions of consumption, which itself is quite an individualized way to think about it. So we're not trying to romanticize the past or make a different kind of hero figure, like that we used to know how to do everything and now we've forgotten and we need to remember, because there are problematic aspects to that storyline as well. Particularly, it tends to place indigenous groups in the past rather than in the present. But what we are saying is that there are common threads between anti-racist, anti-colonial, environmental movements through this period. For example, their shared interests in land, labour and livelihoods. So that comes to back to the "all we want is the earth" of the title. That's where the convergence is, even where they're fighting for different aspects of that. So when we are weaving in these narratives of figures associated with anti-colonialism, we include characters who you wouldn't normally see included in histories of environmentalism. So here we're questioning, you know, that idea of who is the protagonist, but we're also questioning how we think about agency in a collective sense, that the capacities that were enacted in this period that were positive and produced positive dynamism in relation to environmentalism didn't just come from one or two individuals. It came at a convergence of different movements. So, you were mentioning a couple of key figures there. One of the most interesting individuals to us who was involved at the intersection of agrarian and anti-colonial movements was Amilcar Lopez da Costa Cabral. He was a Bissau Guinean and Cape Verdean agronomist, and he was also one of the leading revolutionary figures in African anti-colonial struggles. Like Sylvia Winter, he's also somebody who was between contexts. He moved between parts of Africa and Europe, and was able to kind of develop a critique partly because of that geographic mobility, potentially. And as well as being an intellectual and organisational driver in liberation movements in Guinea-Bissau and Angola, he also developed novel approaches to soil repair that influenced practices in Europe as well. So he set up experimental farms where new ideas could be tested. He developed ideas that connected sort of a language around alienation from land as being a colonial impulse with reclaiming those practices to revive the soil. So some of the approaches he developed were quite pioneering in terms of not just what they were doing in terms of agriculture, nor just what they were doing in terms of like reclaiming a sovereignty to decide, but the connections between farmers, technology, soil, plants and climate. So sort of showing how these things are part of each other. And in that sense, we also suggest he could be seen as one of the early proponents of what we now call food sovereignty, which is the concept expressing the rights of post-colonial nations and peasant communities, etc., to choose how and where to grow. So there's a way in which he connects these different things together that's really innovative. And also it's interesting that in telling the story of environmentalism or even of agroecology, many people haven't even heard of Cabral. So we want to raise that question. We also include in that chapter a bit of work on Sylvia Winter, who definitely isn't usually considered an environmentalist. She definitely does write about land. But again, because it's not in that way of diagnosing ecological issues primarily, she tends to be grouped and siloed in what we might call literary critique or cultural theory, political theory. So Sylvia Winter is a transdisciplinary scholar, and she was engaged in early post-colonial and post-civil rights movements between the 1950s and 1970s. She lived between the Caribbean, London, Europe, and engaged with questions as diverse as dance, theatre, and literature. And why we include her here is particularly because of how pertinent her ideas are to this rejection of one worldism and pointing to other visions that are emerging at this time. One of the things she writes about in her early work in the early 1970s she contrasts the kind of indigenous peasant agriculture and plain Caribbean and colonial systems as kind of making this plot versus plantation distinction. And then she wants to kind of explore how the former might be part of recasting a political and social environmental future beyond colonial coordinates. So she is really interested in the kind of like Mexican agroecologists in existing practice, its ecological relationships, how it works, and in reclaiming that, but also what she does in kind of understanding the plantation and how it works and how it gets its grippiness is she makes a wider critique of the ways we think about the human and we think about humanity more generally. It's quite kind of intense, thick theory, but one of the key parts of it is she's sort of looking at the racialized way what we understand of the human is composed. And then she wants to say, if we want to get beyond this, we can't keep using these categories. We've got to undo them, unmake them. I'm not sure I want to be a human in these terms myself. So there's a kind of unsettling of the underlying aesthetics, including that one worldism, this idea that we are a planetary whole and we all are similar. And she sort of looks at the ways in which there is a kind of rejected or subjected aspect of humanity that keeps being remade by the ways we talk about other things, including the land. So her work is quite theoretical, but in its kind of contextual specificity to the ecological devastation in Caribbean, offers a lot of coordinates in how to think politically about the environment. And just as you say, other terms were thought about much more politically in that moment. The idea of the third world was presented very politically in this moment as a way of unsettling one worldism, exactly. And it's in kind of subsequent decades that it's become more associated with that humanitarianism, humanitarian pity politics, the idea of like, we need to help the third world, us in the kind of global north. So that's a kind of subsequent shift that's happened. But in this moment, we're looking at how that politics was enacted and how important it was to some of the kind of ways that environments and environmentalism were conceptualized. And we don't want, although we can't really go back to using language like the third world, it's kind of moved on from that. We do think that kind of political vibrancy and some of the concepts that we used can be really useful in looking forward to the future as well.
God, that's really, really, really useful and so interesting, because I certainly hadn't come across Sylvia Winter's work at all. So it certainly inspired me to read more about it. And yeah, and I mean, it strikes me that like very often now when we talk about, for example, the effects of climate change, that, you know, we do get this sort of kind of nodding acknowledgement of, oh yeah, for example, in Bangladesh or, you know, or India or somewhere else, they're at the real sharp end of it. But the representation is like of exactly that kind of pity politics. Do you know what I mean? You know, that there aren't activists, there aren't commentators, there isn't science, there isn't knowledge from the rest of the world. Do you mean that everything comes back to the kind of center European Western kind of imaginary of how environmentalism should be done or understood? And I think that's kind of really strong in terms of that chapter of like just blowing that open completely and making those really important connections. I think it does also maybe tie into the kind of next issue, which is, I suppose, the kind of mainstreaming of environmentalism. And in particular, I suppose, the emergence of sustainable development as the kind of the primary category for how we should understand development. So that happens in 1987 in the wake of the Brundtland Report. And this is a time of the the end, not end of the so-called Cold War. There's a lot of grandiosity around the end of history. All these kind of claims are being made. And sort of sustainable development comes on stream as the kind of the normative version of development at that time. And again, I think that has implications for that kind of one world idea. I think there's a kind of a strong connection there and its limitations. But also, at the same time, sustainable development seems like a really great thing. You know, it seems uncontroversially like a good thing and that we should all just get behind it. In fact, I think we are encouraged all over the place to be getting behind it. And Paddy, but though you have a number of concerns about it, actually, and you kind of raise them in the context of the book. And would you mind maybe elaborating a little bit on why you see that as a kind of a, what are the limitations of, I suppose, what, as what we understand as sustainable development?
Sure. I keep getting the questions about, you know, why do you have questions about, you know, these relatively benign things? You know, but no, I think it is important. It's a really important question. And I think what we do, I mean, we're not historians, but what we try to do is in raising these questions about something like sustainable development and the kind of global architecture that was taking shape at that time, late 80s, early 90s, is not just from our perspective, say, oh, this problem's retrospectively, look how this has happened. It's to look at the fact that this was contested at the time, that there were, you know, many organizations and many groups and many you know, scholars and so on, activists who were raising concerns and staging disagreement with the terms of sustainable development as it was sort of evolving. So I think one of the key things between, say, the 1968s, early 70s to the late 80s, 90s, in terms of this consolidation of modern environmentalism, one of the key things that changes in that period is a move from a kind of limits to growth type model and a kind of a, you know, oh, and there's environmental problems and how are we going to respond, you know, to this? It's seen as something negative. In the late 80s, early 90s, as you said, there is this new optimism, which is definitely aligned with the fall of the Berlin Wall, end of the Soviet bloc, breakup of the Soviet bloc. And this idea of a kind of a genuinely one world capitalist, liberal, you know, political economic system. And, you know, that optimism, you know, which then gets sort of, I think, channeled through the idea of, okay, now what we need to do is just solve some of these problems, these environmental problems. Climate change becomes, this is the time when climate change becomes kind of the issue in a way, in terms of global environmental governance, I mean, also biodiversity. But you have the IPCC, International Panel on Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, set up 1988, Rio Conference in 1992. So really that is the consolidation of the institutions in terms of the way in which science is collected, the way in which science feeds into policy, the ways in which transnational agreements are being sort of worked out. But at the same time, again, like we talked about in the 68 with the one worldism, at the same time, you have what the Midnight Notes Collective call the new enclosures. And it's interesting, actually, it's not made clear in the book, but the Midnight Notes Collective was a collective which had quite a lot of the same people involved in Zero Work, Silvia Federici, George Kafensis. And actually, Silvia Federici, in the 70s, 80s, she'd moved to Nigeria and she taught there with George Kafensis. And she quite a lot of her understanding of kind of reproductive work and what it meant for women to do reproductive work expanded in that context beyond the house as four walls to think about land, to think about care for species, ecology, and so on. So you can see that there are clear connections between these currents of thought that change over time, but also there's a consistency. And the new enclosures was basically linked with structural adjustment. So the debt crisis in the 80s, all across the third world, which was now becoming the victim, was now becoming the place where there was poverty, where there was developmental problems. In order to sort of solve those problems, in inverted commas, they were being opened up through structural adjustment. That is, you know, free trade policies, you know, anti-union, you know, buying up of land, having to sell off public assets and so on. So Latin America, Africa. So that kind of the promise of that anti-colonial moment, a lot of that had very quickly buckled under imperialist pressures, and now into the 80s, 90s, they were buckling again under the IMF, the World Bank, and these financial institutions. and their ability to sort of transform their relationships to land, to food production, to resources was massively stymied by these new sort of financial and economic imperatives that were imposed on them. And so what you see is the same as with NAFTA, which is the Zapatistas in 94, is a direct response to NAFTA, which is a free trade agreement between Canada, North America, and Mexico. All of these free trade policies, you see responses on the ground from particularly territorial communities. So this is a shift, which is an important one, which there are certainly questions that we don't go into in the book, but it's less about national sovereignty. What you start to see is a kind of a territorial autonomy or local autonomy within these nation states. So the Ogoni is in the Niger Delta, Zapatistas is in the Chiapas in Mexico. And in other places, you see this with the breakup of the Soviet Union even. You start to see that it's often linked with ideas of indigeneity, certain kinds of place-based cultures and identities. But they are making claims over their resources and saying, we do not want to participate in this neoliberal global order. So there is, again, a disagreement with the terms of what seems quite benign, seems globalization, seems fine. We see these protests or struggles as very much part of an environmental, again, a wider sort of fabric, as Naomi was kind of teasing out earlier, this sort of a kind of a fabric of struggles, which really takes shape around ultra-globalization in the 90s. I mean, you know, that's what ultra-globalization was, linking a lot of different struggles, whether it was, you know, labor or environmental or indigenous, around a rejection of, you know, globalized neoliberalism.
Yeah, and as you say that, actually, it strikes me that the other place we see the one world globe image is, of course, in books about globalization. So it's kind of interesting the kind of way that iconography kind of invisibilizes a lot of the kind of struggles that you're talking about there. So that's just kind of struck me there, that the second place you see them in environment books about the environmental politics, and then you also see them in books about globalization. And the same work is being done by maybe the image in both contexts. And Naomi, I think that I work with students sometimes, we talk about the concepts of kind of globalization and what it might mean and the different variations of it. And I suppose it's become a kind of a, now there's a lot of discussion about like anti-globalization movements, but they come from the right. You know what I mean? You know, like there's a kind of backlash idea. But in the book, there is this sort of celebration and kind of memory of these like really important struggles around issues related to globalization, food resource extraction, dispossession, movements that were absolutely central around these, that were concretely doing work in real places, but also connecting with much wider kind of constituencies of people across the globe. And among them are like La Via Campesina. Paddy's mentioned the Zapatistas, and also the movement for the survival of the Ogoni people. And again, those movements aren't often thought about together as sort of, you know, as in some way sort of part of some kind of maybe shared way of looking at the world. And they're also not often associated with the environmental movement or environmental politics. So maybe tell us a little bit about them and why you felt it was necessary to center them in this book as kind of part of a kind of an ecological politics.
Sure thing. Yeah. So I think one of the reasons we picked those three movements for that chapter four, is because of the ways we see them asserting really important disagreements both within and beyond environmentalism. So we have, as you've pointed out, quite often been focusing on movements who don't get considered as being part of environmental movements at all. So that's kind of an interesting choice. But what our point is here is often those movements are precisely not associating with the growing environmental movement because it started to consolidate in ways that make particular assumptions about the world, about the planet, and about humanity. So what they do is they organize to protect ecologies or to make assertions about governance, how it should happen, or present concerns as political that aren't being perceived as political, in their own terms. And then the second part that we focus on that book is the way that through those movements, particular figures consolidate as ways of telling the story of what's happening, and that they start to circulate around the world and affect the ways that other claims are being made. So even though they're only peripherally sometimes connected with what we would call modern environmentalism, they actually have substantial impact on the way that environmental themes and concepts end up being thought about. So I guess what we mean by figures there are individuals sometimes, or tropes that come from often a particular location, or sometimes from the resonance between locations, but they are made to kind of they are made to buzz or hum with the struggles that different people are facing. So they come to take on an iconic quality. They come to take on something which is like, although this belongs to that place, in it I can see my own struggle and a way of dealing with it. And I think that's really important. Those figures become really central to this mode of politics we're talking about, precisely because they continue and develop the critique to one worldism that we were just talking about a moment ago. So rather than come up with one size fits all solutions, which we're increasingly seeing as we move into the 1990s in the name of environmentalism, particular models, particular ways of zoning, particular ways of organizing solutions that should be rolled out in different places. There's a shared acknowledgement, yes, we need to organize collectively en masse, but also a sense that we actually need to work out what that looks like differently in different places. There are different social environmental histories in play. There are different political claims in play. So it's not going to look like the same thing in each place. So the movements that we pick are quite different from each other, but they have that common thread of becoming figures that move around the world. So I'll just say about each one of them. So the La Via Campesina is essentially a social movement. It was consolidated. La Via Campesina means kind of peasant life in Spanish, but it emerged as a transnational movement in the 1990s and emerged precisely to reject particular ideas of food security as they were being consolidated in that moment. And amid acknowledgement of a global hunger problem, the idea that that could be solved by global agreements and also primarily export-oriented solutions that would incentivize indebted nations to consolidate a strategy for global export crops and so kind of stabilize their food sources and also income. But important objections were posed by peasant movements, indigenous movements, and others, because this didn't really allow, firstly, for continuation of livelihoods and ways of growing and organizing land that had persisted for centuries. But secondly, it really forcibly tries to push those nations into participation in the global economy, liberalized borders, etc., in ways that wouldn't actually be good for them. So food sovereignty is about maintaining autonomy, political autonomy of groups in how to grow and what to grow. And the figure that we identify emerging through that struggle is the figure of Madre Tierra, or Mother Earth. Madre Tierra is often obviously tied to particular cosmologies. There are images of Mother Earth in Mayan cosmologies in across Mexico and other parts of Latin America, where the sort of there are the different ways of representing Madre Tierra, but it's kind of the idea of a woman as the land. But you also, in Bolivia and other parts of Latin America, have Pachamama, a different articulation of Madre Tierra, which is visually represented differently, but with a kind of common sets of ethos. So what interested me, and I have written separately about this, was kind of what is this concept doing? Is it trying to collapse everything into one? Does it feminize workers' claims? Is it problematic that it's rendered feminine and that it's in Spanish and it's sort of not a cosmology at all? It's a kind of collapsed cosmology. But actually what I found through the empirical work that I've done is that this figure plays a really important political role in keeping those questions open. And against the idea of a one worldism, it's a kind of an appeal to the notion that in relation to questions of land, there are many dimensions of liveliness in dialogue with each other. It's kind of an appeal to the singularity of particular contexts and their relationship with ontology, as in the kind of way of knowing the world, as well as political claims that might emerge from that. So I personally find Mardotiera a very politicized concept. But what's important in the chapter is also the ways that the kind of collective claims made in the name of Madre Tierra function on the global stage and start to kind of interact with ideas of the environment and food growing, etc. It also, a bit later in the book, we use the idea of the pluriverse to get at this idea of moving beyond. So the one worldism revolves around a kind of universal idea of culture and of nature, this idea that we humans share one planet. And the basis of the idea of the pluriverse is that there isn't one nature underneath that we all share. There are many natures that can be rendered very differently. So Madre Tierra, in some sense, is for me a pluriversal concept. It kind of wants to keep that open while also moving towards strategies for environmental futures and for how do we, you know, keep alive these possibilities for the future. So we do something similar in relation to the Ogoni movements led by Ken Sarawiwa in relation to the Niger Delta and the Zapatista movement. I might see if Paddy wants to come in here because those particularly emerge from his own work.
Yeah, sure. It can be brief. I think, you know, just picking up some of those themes, you know, that we're trying to draw across these three different examples, and we could have chosen any again. I mean, there's so much going on. I was just thinking there about Chico Mendes and the Rubber Tappers Union, which is a massive one in the late 1980s in Brazil and the Amazon. You know, in Rob Nixon's book, Slow Violence, a lot of the examples he talks about are actually also from this era when there was a kind of a number of these movements against resource extraction and against environmental, you know, destruction across, you know, Africa and Latin America. But I think I was particularly drawn to the Ogoni and Ken Sarawiwa because of the connection to Ireland, which seems unlikely. And that goes to this question of the internationalism, but I think also goes to this idea of resonance, which we talk a bit about more later on in the book. But, you know, this sort of, it was a relationship that, to very briefly, Niger Delta is in the south of Nigeria. Royal Dutch Shell got the license basically to drill for oil the year before Nigeria got independence, had been drilling oil for a long time. Royalties had gone to the Nigerian state. These royalties had progressively gotten less, and very little of that money went to the Niger Delta. So in the mid-1980s, people living around the Niger Delta were dealing with all sorts of, you know, problems that had come out of that extractive industry, the pollution of water, pollution of air, flaring of gas, for example, that meant that there wasn't even access to sort of darkness, which was a really kind of, I think, moving thing that Rob Nixon talks about in his work on this. And the Ogoni were one of many indigenous peoples that lived there that were particularly affected by this. And the movement, MOSOP, or the Ogoni movement that was sort of founded by Ken Sarawiwa, who was a writer, academic, who was originally from there, basically developed a movement to sort of raise awareness about what was going on there and to challenge the Nigerian state to not necessarily stop the drilling, but to ensure that there was environmental protection, to ensure there was investment in the area, to ensure that livelihoods were protected, that relied on the health of the environment, the waters and the soils and so on. And that movement was very successful in reaching an international stage. So this point that Naomi was getting at is that why was it at this time that the Zapatistas also, I don't think we have time probably to go into all of it, but these were sort of remote, particularly the Ogoni and Zapatistas. They were remote in the sense that they were far removed from capital or metropolitan centers. They were not well networked. This was one of the issues that they make. There was poor infrastructure. You couldn't access these territories. And yet resources that were central to the global capitalist economy and that were feeding consumption in the north were being taken from here. So this sort of image of a kind of a vampiric globalization or global capital that the Zapatistas really drew on. So how was it that these groups that were not that well networked managed to sort of enter onto an international stage and become sort of key players within ultra-globalization movement, within the rethinking of environmental struggles? How did they do that? Through what techniques, through what strategies, through what aesthetic techniques? And this is the idea of the trope or the figure that we talk about in this book, Marcos, Subcamandante Marcos, and a lot of the kind of imagery of the Zapatistas. Anyone who knows anything about the Zapatistas will be aware of, so successful also in using the internet, the early days of the internet, to access, a much wider audience. And then the Ogoni and Ken Saro-Wiwa, one of the things I think particularly interesting is that he drew on all of his international connections. And one of those connections was Sister McCarran, who was an Irish nun who was working in Nigeria as a missionary. And I think it's interesting because the missions are kind of a legacy of a colonial era. And they are kind of a colonial infrastructure, if you want, or a connection between former colonies and the metropole. And yet these infrastructures or these connections can be used for anti-colonial purposes. And Ken Saro-Wiwa and Sister McCarran became very close friends, and Sister McCarran became an important interlocutor or vehicle for translating what was happening with the Ogoni and their struggle to a wider audience. And there was efforts to sort of boycott Shell, and there was, consumer-based campaigns to sort of target Shell at the petrol pump, for a bit like with the great boycott we talked about earlier. And they were successful, and there was attention brought. Ultimately, they weren't successful because Ken Saro-Wiwa, unfortunately, and other activists were executed by the Nigerian state in 1995. But one of the very hopeful things that we talk about in the book is how that struggle sort of passed on to other places and moved elsewhere. And one of those places was Mayo. So the most unlikely connection between the Niger Delta and Northern Mayo, where Shell put in to have this gas pipeline, the Corrib gas pipeline, and what is possibly one of the most important social movements, environmental struggles in Ireland the last 30, 40 years, happened there and was partly sort of supported by Sister McCarran and what she had seen and learnt in the Niger Delta and what she brought to that struggle. And I think one of the things it brought was that international connection. And I think what's so inspiring or interesting for us, and it's not resolved in the book, resonance is a term we kind of fall on because we used it when we were talking, but it's really this idea that there is a connection between this place and this place, even though these places are very different. How are these connections made beyond a kind of a tokenistic solidarity? Because we can all have solidarity with other places and other struggles, but what is it that forges a connection which really seems like a strong and meaningful connection? And obviously lots of people have thought about that and worked on it, and it's not an easy thing. I mean, part of it is not just a rational or intellectual thing. It happens through personal connections. It happens through sort of aesthetic moments. And in the Shell to Sea struggle, some of those are things like the mural that was painted in Rossport, which is a mural of a Ken Saro-Wiwa poem translated into Irish. So that idea of translation between language, between place, between struggles, that is such important work that for us is a key part of what resonance is. Resonance is the work of connecting between these different sites and different struggles, whether that is environmental and labor, or whether that is place and a place, or whether that is the present and the past. Those are all different forms of resonance.
Fabulous. Yeah. Actually, as you say it, in Cork, back around maybe mid early 2000s, we used to have an event in memory of Ken Saro-Wiwa, and Sister Magella used to come to that. But also, it was interesting because that event, an annual event, would kind of bring together like people who were active around environmental struggles in Cork, for example, the Safe Harbour people. But also, we had people from Mayo kind of contributing to it as well. So, and it was a way of how do we kind of recognize the kind of singularity and specificity of the struggles that are occurring in particular places and making particular demands on particular groups of people. But that kind of home of resonance was there. Do you know what I mean? It was made being very real in that room. So I found that really, again, it was one of those moments in the book that kind of made me think about connections that I hadn't thought about for quite a while. Do you know? And I found that kind of really moving for that reason as well, you know, in terms of what it kind of sparked off in me personally, but also in terms of the kind of friendships and the forms of solidarity that can exist and be very powerful at particular times. I'm very conscious, Patty, that I have been asking you all the questions about, like, why is this a bad concept? So I'm not going to ask you about why the Anthropocene is a limited concept, okay, in terms of how it's represented. Instead, I'm actually going to maybe Naomi first, but also then you might want to come in. And it's, I suppose, it's this idea of earth politics, which I think is like one of the kind of points of where the book kind of comes to a close, even though that there are other discussions afterwards. But it's really, really important. And it's very vibrant, it's very inspiring. And again, this ability to sort of, this kind of notion of resonance comes through again very strongly. Things are not identical, they're not all the same. And I suppose what you're talking about is kind of ecological struggles that have a very, very strong sort of resonance in Latin America, the 2010 Earth Summit that took place in Bolivia, and with the involvement of Evo Morales, the president. That seems to have been a very defining moment. But in that kind of notion of earth politics, there are very diverse threads and traditions. So you talk about, for example, the importance of indigenous knowledge, movements around witnessing, soil repair, food justice, the rights of rivers. Again, Madre Tierra, again, is a kind of a central figure. And you write that when indigenous ontologies are taken seriously, it becomes clear that not only human subjects, but living and non-living matter can be regarded as active participants in disputes over land and environment. And I think that idea will be challenging for many people, the idea of like non-humans also being part of the kind of populations that are conversing around the kind of environment and ecological politics. So it would be great, maybe Naomi first and then Patty, if you could maybe tell us a little bit about what you think earth politics is and why you think it's so important for radically rethinking, I think, our relationships between human and non-human and our relationship with the environment more generally.
Yeah, great. So from the 1990s moving into the 2000s, we sort of see important shifts happening both academically in terms of how environmental politics is being written about, thought about, but also in terms of how environmental movements are organizing and more than environmental movements, if you like, in the terms of the book, also stage their terms. So this earth politics is trying to kind of capture some of that movement. So the academic movement really is to place increasing emphasis on the importance of ontology in environmental politics. So what I mean by ontology really is the kind of concern with the ways we know the world and the possibility or not to stage disagreement between one person's account and another. So we've been kind of coming at this idea in different ways through this conversation, the idea of one worldism sort of being a way of rendering the world as if it's obvious and we all agree, but that sidelines and excludes other ways of knowing the world that wouldn't fit within that. So in the terms I phrased it earlier, the kind of the appearance of the part with no part, for Rancière was about political movements in Europe, but here we might think of that as how do you stage knowledge that isn't allowed to count into the discussion, especially if it's considered to be quite central to the question itself, like ecological survival, etc. So here we see an increasing concern to take cosmologies, other cosmologies, indigenous cosmologies or modes of practice, including their relationship with technologies, etc., which is something that I work on, but to take them seriously and in their own terms and to think about the ways in which they make claims on global forms of organising and interrupt smooth flow of those kinds of discussions and even point fingers at the ways that those tables can be organised in ways that don't include whole segments and proportions of global population and the ways that would come with that of knowing the world. So one of the key points that emerges from that literature is really the idea that different ways of knowing the world are incommensurable. That means they can't be collapsed into each other. They can't be reduced to each other. They can't even really be expressed properly in each other's terms. There's something that gets lost. And that kind of acknowledgement of incommensurability is seen to be kind of central to a mode of doing environmental politics that doesn't do a lot of cultural violence, that doesn't ask entire groups to conform to others' terms in order to kind of participate. So we see, for example, in global summits, there's increasing momentum towards notions of nature accounting, market strategies to kind of save nature, different kind of ways of using quite capitalist ideas to motivate and incentivize the kind of survival of the species. I think these are kind of strategies we'd be anyway quite critical of. What does it mean when you don't even have a common idea of what nature is? What about if you don't have a concept of nature? The binary doesn't exist for you because you don't have a version of culture, which is to be contrasted with that of nature. The whole thing falls down and then it becomes impossible to kind of have a conversation, or somebody sets the terms of the conversation, but that means that other claims don't appear. So that's the kind of thing we're working through. And I guess a really useful term as well to bring in the mix here is earth beings, which is a term that Marisol de la Cadena uses to describe something which is not a new phenomenon. And in her work, she's an anthropologist, she's working in Peru, she's talking about mountains like Alsangate in the Peruvian Andes, where the Runacuna people live in relation to this mountain being that they are in dialogue with. Which is an important reason they can't contemplate the notion of extractive mining of that same mountain. But they cannot present that reason in the forum for why they shouldn't mine the mountain. In the end, in the collaboration with others, they are successful in rejecting the claim, but they have to make it in cultural terms or by kind of talking about the damage on nature. So they have to do a lot of translating work to get that claim to be heard. And I guess De La Cadena's question is, what would we need to do to the global stages of politics to mean that earth beings could appear as earth beings in their own terms? So that's the nature of earth politics. It wants to get at the ontological nature of environmental politics, not just to kind of get people together to organise for common aims, but to disturb the ways we think about environments in common and to look at the uncommon aspects of these conversations. So we're talking about ways of articulating collective action towards biodiversity loss, climate crisis, etc., that are planetary, both in their scale and in the sense that they're earthly and they engage with the matter of the life of the planet as part of the calls of action they make. Yeah, and quite distinctively from the notions of the Anthropocene that we're quite critical of, they break away from that one worldist vision. They break away from the notion that there is one humanity that is, you know, a new force on the planet. We understand why that's an interesting idea, but it breaks away with that unified, universalized notion of humanity and the solutions that might come with that, seeking to put plurality, disagreement, and the kind of gap between different ways of knowing at the heart of the designs that emerge as a result. And there are others like Arturo Escobar, whose ideas really inspired us there. He has a book called Designs for the Pluriverse. And really what he's getting at there is the idea that we have to begin with disagreement over the givens of the known worlds and the idea that we can't have one common blueprint for what to do about it before we can move towards anything like solutions. I don't know if Paddy wants to add or alter anything that I've put forward there.
Great. Oh, Paddy, you're coming in, are you? Great. That's really, really useful. And I think that, like, that is a very radical kind of way to, I mean, it's really pushing us at towards the end of the book to really move beyond the kind of that we all have to see things in the same way in order to be able to, you know, be collective actors and to kind of, you know, push back against sort of destruction and damage and exploitation and extraction. So it's very, very powerful and interesting. And I think that your readers will really find it provocative and challenging as well. As we're just going to maybe round up, I just wanted to maybe just like finish by asking you, I suppose, obviously you've written this book together, which is kind of a really interesting process in itself, I'm sure. And maybe like, where would you like to go next? And what would you like maybe readers of the book, how do you want them to engage with the arguments, or what would you like them to sort of to do with the kind of work that you've presented them with them in this book?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think your response to the book is really nice. If other people had a similar response, I mean, I think from other people who've read it, and I think the way that Naomi and I wrote it, and going back to our motivation, is that you know, even though there is a strong critical impulse and we are critiquing modern environmentalism, anyone who reads the book knows it's not just a work of critique. I mean, what we're really trying to do is just like give air to, you know, all of these struggles that are just so inspiring and hopeful, and sort of reclaim them for now. So I think that's certainly one thing, even at a kind of an affective level, that the book is something that sort of, you know, yes, is inspiring or hopeful in some way. I guess, you know, my own sense in terms of writing the book, and obviously we went through a lot of different material and things like that, and we weren't, you know, the aim of the book wasn't to sort of come up with, like, you know, these are the five things people should do, or this is our intervention into the debate on eco-socialism. And we were quite conscious of that, because at times we thought we'd write a concluding chapter trying to say, like, this stuff is relevant to these conversations, but we made a point to not do that. But I also think that that's maybe a cop-out to some extent, or it's a way in which we, you know, because we have thought about those and still struggle with those questions. And since writing the book, I mean, I certainly feel, for example, one question that looms large for me that is not resolved is around the kind of, you know, the sort of Third World Project and the anti-colonial movements, which were sort of national liberation struggles that were really about delinking these, you know, former colonies from, you know, the world system as it was being shaped, you know, particularly the capitalist world system. And that project has not been successful, as, you know, as we just described. But I think then that last chapter, which Naomi was talking about there around the earth politics, what we see in the last 10, 15 years is like an upsurge in decolonial politics and decolonial thought, particularly, you know, say within the academy. But there is an interest in decolonial theory, particularly as an epistemic project. And those two things are often, not often, but they can be seen as in contradiction, or how do they fit? And for me, at least, I'm trying to think, particularly in the context of Ireland, where there are a very lively set of and sites of struggle, you know, really interesting in the last 3, 4, 5 years. And we end the book, in fact, with a coda talking about that, the visit of the Zapatistas, the Making Relatives, the climate camp that was this summer. There seems to be a lot that's happening, anti-mining, you know, around forestry, around farming, land, a lot of things are about land. And I think that within those specific sites, and my head is usually in those sites most of the time, thinking about them, is that I can see that there is a need to think about anti-colonial politics in Ireland, including in the context of a united Ireland, and what that might look like, and the extent to which Ireland is very much subservient to the needs of global capital. So that has to be confronted. But at the same time, within a lot of these campaigns and struggles, I'm particularly thinking about in the Sperrins, for example, which is in Tyrone around the border area, you know, many ways in which the resistance to gold mining is articulated is very similar to indigenous struggles elsewhere. And again, very careful to not conflate these things. But the ways in which the defense of place, the protection of place, the value of place, connection to species, to land, along a lot longer history and understanding of dispossession connected to language and culture and so on, the importance of that, which is not just about sort of national ownership of resources, it's about a fundamentally different relationship to land and place. So at least in my head, I'm thinking about how this sort of decolonial impulse and this longer history of anti-colonial politics can nourish each other, or can be brought together in some way as a vital project for more just environmental futures, you know, not just on the island, but around the world. So that's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, great. Thanks for the question. And also for this opportunity to really think about what the book's been about. As Paddy said, I really enjoyed your reading of the book and the ways that you framed it. So really appreciate this conversation. Where I'm going next really is two directions. One is I've been particularly thinking about technologies, so in relation to the environment. So I guess with some of the movements that I feel really associated with and concerned with, sometimes we've got a reluctance to engage with questions of technology and or uncertainty about how to deal with it, knowing that there are ways of using technology which can be very kind of reinforcing of this one worldist, universalist type way of doing things, or can be quite harmful. I look at the use of drones, for example, in conservation spaces, and they are being used to survey and control and sometimes bring in military impulses into what we're calling conservation. But the same technologies are also being appropriated in different ways. I'm increasingly working with an international network of people who use drones for community-led monitoring, either in relation to kind of rural communities and community-led forestry, or in relation to indigenous land protection and defence. And it's interesting, as I get deeper into those dialogues, that these ontological questions come up of like, drones are being understood in relation to dragonflies, in relation to particular birds, in relation to ecosystems and early warning systems. So there's kind of this really imaginative way of rethinking technology, techne, meaning how, to develop and put forward these kind of same principles of earth politics, I think. But that's sort of one thing I've been really concerned with. And the other one is kind of unexpected, at least for me, and I'm getting involved in fictional projects, one in particular to work with historical narratives of resistance, especially to different kinds of enclosure and the clearances in Scotland, and to work quite creatively with those fictions, on the one hand going deeper into a research process and in dialogue with people who live in those areas, and on the other seeking to allow a story to express itself in a different register. I'm finding that really enlivening. And I guess that kind of gets me to the point of where I'd love this to land, which is, I think let's get creative in how we think about environmental politics. Now, I don't mean it's not urgent. I don't mean that if we don't do it, you know, it's going to be okay. I think there is a real imperative. Sometimes we can get so into the imperatives that we don't notice that the way we're doing the organising is actually reinforcing the problem or particular kinds of problem, and that the same people are not being part of that conversation, or that the methods reflect colonial histories rather than moving beyond them. I think it's a time that requires all our energies to be moving in creative ways, but it also needs our best efforts at art and literature and imagining the world, as well as our best efforts at organising. And I think when the two come together, we see ways of looking beyond the current conjecture that are really exciting. Maybe we do need to also contemplate the possible non-existence of the human species. You know, there's definitely a call to not just be hopeful, but I think that he's being ready to engage different registers in relation to social movements is important, and it's something that social movements have always done. So that would be my kind of hope in terms of the book, its project, its legacy, that we can be part of a movement of people that is seeking to think creatively about where next and how, and yeah, that we give our best efforts to that.
Fabulous. That was fabulous. And I think, I suppose, as a reader of the book, I felt, you know, you talked about the affective dimension, Paddy. I absolutely did feel like, I didn't feel like broken by the book or depressed by it, which is so often what the experience of reading about like climate change and the kind of environmental moment. I felt positive in the sense of that there is these rich traditions that can give us strength and give us courage. Do you know, in the face of what's with us now and what's in front of us. But also what you're talking about there, Naomi, that kind of creativity, because I think the book itself is a very creative project in terms of knitting together and making these connections and, you know, talking about resonances. So I just want to say thank you very much. It's been an absolute delight for me to talk with you both today. And I think the readers and the listeners and readers will get a huge amount out of your book. So thank you very, very much for joining us.